Okay, if you're ready, we'll go ahead and call the case. It's case number 61558, Oxbo Inspection LLC versus the 8th Judicial District Court and the Regent of Town Center Homeowners Association, being real party in interest. We have Mr. Carlson for the petitioner here, Mr. Mayfield, I see here for the respondent. And go ahead, Mr. Carlson, if you proceed. Also, Justice Hardesty, who is not present today, is watching this on the Internet as we speak here, and he will participate in the resolution of this case.
Okay, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes, if I may.
Okay.
Chief Justice Gibbons, members of the Supreme Court, if it please the Court. The case that's before you today on the petition is, in my mind, an attempt to get some clarity on the Westpark decision. We are, both of us, I think, unhappy with the trial court ruling. We're both looking for some guidance from the court. Our position is we'd like a bright line so we can tell in subsequent cases, and there may be several, as to how to apply the new language to previously occupied and rented apartment units that have been converted to condominiums. And that's really the thrust of our case. This court dealt with that on two occasions previously. One is the Westpark case and also the ANSI case. In ANSI, just said briefly, this court came out and said subsequent orders are not barred by the language in 11.615, the definition of construction defect. However, in that case, like this case, Oxbo being in both cases, the units in issue in this case were previously occupied, they were rented, albeit we would concede not for a great period of time, unlike the Westpark case where it was almost 7 years. In this case, it varied from a high of about 14 minutes to a low of a few days.
But don't we additionally in this case have a issue because we have, it seems to be a commonality, we have some that are clearly more than others that have rented for whether it's one day or some minor portion, so we have a mixed bag of units. So some that might qualify and some that don't qualify.
And that's really the issue that I think the trial court wrestled with. That's the court, that's the issue we're wrestling with, Justice Douglas. And the issue here, of course, not surprisingly, neither side agrees on how many units were occupied and how many weren't. We believe that the popular amount is 246 out of 274 were leased and occupied. The plaintiff believes there's a different number. That's based upon what evidence was available to produce at the time. I don't think we're going to agree with that. I don't think the trial court made a determination on that. I don't think this court has made a determination on that. What this court we're seeking is, can you tell us if, and the real difficulty we have with this is that the units are not grouped in such a fashion that we could say this building gets Chapter 40 and this building doesn't get Chapter 40, because at least our analysis is that of the units that we couldn't find a lease for, they're spread out throughout the entire project. And there's no building that is either fully leased or fully not leased. And so we're going to have a situation where there's a unit in each building or maybe 2 units that have perhaps under the court's, trial court's ruling rights to a Chapter 40 remedy, and then the rest of the units won't. And from our point of view, that's pretty unworkable. We can't even figure out how to do that, especially in light of the fact that the individual unit owners are not the plaintiffs. I mean, if this was a joinder case, we'd have a lot easier time. Because we have is a representative action. And representative action then puts us in a situation where how are we going to figure out, in a practical sense, who gets what and what the association can recover, and are we going to have to now individually litigate the rights of each unit owner of each unit? Well, I would retract that. Units don't have rights. Our position has always been we're never sued by a house. We're sued by the person who owns the house, and so we would have to litigate which unit owners have rights in Chapter 40 and which unit owners don't. And in representative action, that's particularly difficult. And so we're faced with, they think everybody, and I, of course,
when we're talking, you know, understand, but my understanding of their position is all units and therefore all owners fall within the purview of Chapter 40. Our position is that because of a large percentage that isn't, and there are no units, no buildings that have any units that weren't previously occupied, that none of them should fall within the Chapter 40 purview. And then the secondary issue that's been presented by the plaintiffs, which we don't agree with, is whether an impertinence has to be new or not. And that language comes from NRS 40.615. And as the court's aware, a construction defect means a defect in design, construction, manufacture, repair, or landscaping of a new residence. And it goes on to say of an alteration or an addition to an existing residence or an improvements. And I think the reliance for the plaintiff side, or the homeowner association side in this case, is that new is not repeated throughout the remainder of that definition phrase. And frankly, this court did not address that in West Park. And it also didn't address the issue about appurtenances in West Park. And I understand the position of the homeowner association is appurtenance, one, don't have to be new, and two, they encompass a separate category that doesn't require an analysis of new. And I don't believe that really makes much sense, and this court has gone to some great lengths to talk about the fact that you don't want an absurd result. And the only time I was able to find any mention of this issue was in the Nancy case, this is 8th Judicial District, 124 Nevada 862, under footnote 17, where this court comments, NRS Chapter 40 also provides relief for defects containing new appurtenances and alterations or additions to an existing residence or appurtenance. That's not a direct quote from the statute, but it is a direct quote from the footnote, where this court talked about a new appurtenance. And then we get the analysis of how we analyze the appurtenance versus the unit itself, and I think in a logical fashion, in a reasonable fashion, in a real world fashion, is that the units are built, the appurtenances are associated with the units, they also rise and fall under the West Park analysis. They don't get independent analysis, and because that doesn't make any logical sense, and it also doesn't report the reality, which is the units are made, the associated pools, walkways, roads, garages are all made in association with this new construction, and therefore they should be analyzed in the same fashion. Turning into the analysis, this court has always said fairly straightforward that in West Park, if it's not new, it's been occupied prior, then it's not subject to Chapter 40. We think that the court should say that these units act as a whole versus an individualized analysis, and that's really where the difficulty is. As I mentioned before, I don't see how we're going to do analysis, especially in representative action, as to which homeowners are entitled to the recovery which aren't under Chapter 4.
And just to address that point, can you tell me, just so I understand, the nature of this action involved the building envelopes, is that correct? And so how does that play into the individual particularities in any specific unit as opposed to the building envelope and the common areas?
Well, the Chapter 40 was broad. Mm-hmm. It encompassed everything from walkways and sidewalks to the building outside, the roofs, the windows, the doorways, the interior plumbing, the interior electrical, the interior venting. So, and unfortunately, there's been no discovery to really develop that particular issue.
Let me just pause you there. Then why should we be entertaining this on an extraordinary writ? We don't have full discovery. We don't know the problems that the trial court's failure to do what you wanted is causing. We don't have a full record. I understand your opponents aren't really opposing. They're opposing you on the merits. They'd like an order, too. But it worries me that we're doing that with no discovery and no real grasp of what the factual problems are.
Well, if I may, Justice Pickering, the issue that's presented by both sides for the court is fully developed. There isn't going to be any more development other than new or not. What's going to be developed is, I guess, if there is going to be any more development, is what claims are being made. To address paragraph, the billing envelope is some point of contention between the defense bar and the plaintiff's bar, and that's because, for one, it's kind of hard to define. Secondly, in this particular case, the maintenance responsibilities for the walls, the interiors, everything except for the roofs, falls on the individual room owners. The only part that the association is obligated to maintain is the roof area. So when they talk about the billing envelope, I have to kind of...
Again, that was my question. How much does this invade into the individual units themselves as opposed to the common areas and the envelope as a whole?
Well, the plaintiffs have set forth an oral argument, but not changed the Chapter 40 notice, that they're not seeking damages within the individual units.
Okay.
Our difficulty is that these are basically airspace condominiums, and the individual units, they're not seeking anything inside the unit, but they're seeking the part of the unit that actually makes up the unit, if that's not really too obtuse. The doors, the windows, the walls, okay. All of that stuff is part of, at least in my mind, the unit, although definitionally they have airspace ownership rights. But they also have maintenance obligations for all of those things. And so it takes away from the usual, this court may be familiar with, which most of us are really familiar with, is that the association has an obligation to maintain the outside of the units. In this case, they're not. And that brings us into the other area about the limited common area appurtenances and other things that the association feels is separate. Their basic position, if I understand it correctly, is that the units are airspace and everything else is theirs. And that doesn't seem to comport with the CCNRs, nor with the maintenance obligations, nor with a real analysis of what we're talking about in the way of construction. So we are at a loss. We don't believe the trial court was correct in stating that some get it and some don't. And this court came very strongly in the ANSI case, talking about the differential between individuals who are co-located within a condominium project. And I think that one of the criticisms of the ANSI position from some of the subcontractors in that case was that you'd have a homeowner who is brought from the developer and therefore they had Chapter 40 rights, and you had a homeowner who brought from another homeowner and they had no Chapter 40 rights, and that result would be absurd because it would be basically a luck of the draw type of analysis, which really wouldn't be something that's public comments. And so we have the same situation here, except kind of the opposite. In this, it is if the person who purchased a unit that was not occupied, they put the Chapter 40 jackpot. If they purchased one that was occupied, they were precluded. I see my time is up, and I thank the court for that.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Mayfield, because there's two consolidated cases, and one you're the petitioner and one you're the respondent, you have a right to reserve time as well on the second case, 61941. Would you like to reserve any time for that?
Thank you. Chief Justice Gibbons, Associate Justices. I was quite amused when the briefing of the association was called amorphous, concocted, disingenuous, ludicrous, ridiculous, artificially created. I kept reading, I thought I was going to find that we were delirious. The fact is, we took the facts from the record, and with regard to what are units, what are common elements, and what are limited common elements, we took that right out of the declaration in this case. And in this case, the declaration clearly states in section 1.14 that the common elements should mean all of the project except units. So clearly the common elements are completely separate from the units. And it's showing clearly the real estate described in Exhibit B attached herein, including without limitation the following components, the buildings, including, but not by way of limitation, the foundation columns, girders, beams, supports, perimeter and supporting walls,
chimneys, chimney chases, roofs, stairs, patios, balconies, entrances, and exits. I'm going to skip a small portion not relevant, which exists for use by one or more of the owners. So clearly, the common elements themselves are entirely separate from the units. If you look at the deeds, which are part of the appendix and the record in this case, you'll see that what the homeowners got was an interest, a separate interest, in an airspace unit, the boundaries of which I'll discuss in a second, and they also got an undivided, indivisible interest in the common elements in this project. What are the boundaries of the units? In section 1.47 of the CC&Rs of this association, the unit shall be the fee simple interest in a single unit depicted on the plat and plans designated for separate ownership and occupancy, the boundaries of which are described in section 4.2 of this declaration, together with limited common elements appurtenant to the unit, as specified in Article 5, and the undivided interest in the common elements appurtenant. The limited common elements are described as limited common elements in section 1.27 should mean the portion of the common elements allocated for the exclusive use of fewer than all of the owners under the declaration or the act, as I described in Article 5 of this declaration. So all common elements and all limited common elements are entirely separate from the units themselves, which are owned individually by the home purchasers. The common elements are owned by every single owner on the property. Whether they purchased a unit that was occupied prior to it becoming a condominium, or whether they purchased a unit that was unoccupied prior to it becoming a condominium. And their interest, their ownership interest in those common elements, which includes the limited common elements, is indivisible. The boundaries of the units are described in Article 4, Section 4.2. Without reading all of it, let me just tell you that it is an airspace condominium. It's literally bordered by the interior surface, unfinished surface, of the ceilings, the walls, and the foundation beneath it. They only own what's inside that airspace. Everything outside of it is a common element or a limited common element. That section 4.2 and subsection E specifically provides under exclusions, except when specifically included by other provisions of this section, the following are excluded from each unit: the spaces and improvements lying outside the boundaries described in A, B, and C above. And those are the perimeter, vertical perimeter boundaries, the ceiling boundaries, and the foundation boundaries. And all chutes, pipes, flutes, ducts, wireless conduits, skylights, and other facilities running through and within any interior unit, wall or partition, for the purpose of furnishing the utility and similar services to other units and the common elements. So clearly, it excludes everything outside of that. And what we are seeking in this action, and you said this many times in court, and I'll say it again here, is involved in the exterior building envelope, which includes windows here. Now, under limited common elements, which are more specifically defined in Article 5, Section 5.1, it says the following portions of the common elements are limited common elements assigned to the units as stated. Subsection B, any shutters, awnings, window boxes, doorsteps, storage areas, entry areas, stoops, porches, balconies, patios, exterior doors and windows, or other fixtures designed to serve a single unit and identified on the plat and plans as limited common elements located outside the boundaries of the unit, are not excuse me, all limited common elements allocated exclusively to a unit. So there's nothing ridiculous or contorted or concocted or ludicrous about this argument. I'm afraid petitioner in this case doesn't understand the difference between a single-family home where the exterior wall is, in fact, owned by the homeowner and is a part of that home. In a condominium situation such as what we have here, it is not a part of the home. Now, with regard to the maintenance of that exterior envelope, the CC&Rs specifically place the maintenance obligation for roofs, walls, windows, doors, the foundation, upon the association, not upon the homeowners. And I know this court will recall, because Mr. Carlson and I argued this before, in the view of Black Mountain case, that in that case, the entire building envelope was the maintenance obligation rested with the homeowners. That's not the case here. This is an entirely different case, and I believe in that case it was not part of the common area. Here it is part of the common area, which becomes very important when considering whether or not we're going to have to do a Rule 23 analysis. This court in West Park laid down what appeared to be a very bright line rule with regard to what a new residence is. Now, the court made it very clear that it's not important whether we're calling it an apartment or a condominium. What's important is an individual unit title transferred to someone else. Because once it's transferred, it becomes a residence for purposes of Chapter 40. But the issue in West Park was it new? How will we define new? And in that case, we know that the units were rented or occupied for 7 years. So it seemed not silly, but contrary to what we generally believe or ascribe to something that's been held or used for 7 years, to call it new. So the court said, we're going to say that it's only new if it's been unoccupied from the time of the completion of the construction until the time of the transfer. And that was fine until the issue was raised in the Yancey case. What about subsequent purchasers who were the second owners? They were purchasing, if you will, a used residence. Well, the court properly observed that that's going to result in absurd results, which clearly is not in accordance with the policy of this state to protect homeowners and to provide builders with an opportunity to make repairs. And the court gave a couple of examples. It said, the second owner of a one-year home would not have Chapter 40 benefits, but a neighbor who bought from the original developer would have Chapter 40 benefits. That was absurd. The second example was that a subsequent purchaser who got a unit after an action had been filed would have the benefit of NRCP 25, and he would have the benefit of Chapter 40, but a subsequent purchaser who bought before a construction defect action was filed would not have the benefit. And the court properly concluded, we don't believe that it's appropriate. It leads to disparate treatment of otherwise similarly situated homeowners. And frankly, that is what you're going to have here in this particular case. You're going to have similarly situated homeowners who do not receive the benefit of Chapter 40 based upon their age, on the exact same terms as the two examples you gave in this case. Thank you.
Okay, you want to reserve the balance of your time?
Yes.
Thank you.
3 minutes, both.
You really have 4 minutes, over 4.5 minutes left.
Oh, if I could go just to
go to 3. Okay, go ahead.
Now, because we've got common area involved here, and we have anywhere from between 29 and 69 units that are clearly new as defined by West Park, and since those owners have an indivisible interest in all of the common elements, including the building envelopes which we're seeking damages for defects for, they have the right, on behalf of themselves and frankly on behalf of the other members of the association, to pursue defects in all of the building envelopes. Now, It is true, as Mr. Crossan said, that there is an unoccupied unit, and he said in all buildings. I believe it's in 18 out of 20. I believe there are two buildings that were, in fact, entirely occupied before they were sold. But at least in 18 buildings, there's an unoccupied unit, and the owner in that building can pursue construction defects in the building envelope, not only in the building where his unit is, but also in the building envelope in the remainder of the project for the benefit of all of the homeowners. Mm-hmm. And later we address the fact that the association can pursue it in a representative capacity here. And it's not because we meet Rule 23, it's because, again, it's a common element.
Thank you.
I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mayfield. Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Chief Justice Gibbons. The CC&I's says Section 6.1, common element association shall maintain, repair, replace all common elements except the portions of ruined common elements which are required by this declaration to be maintained by the homeowners. The thing goes on, the specific obligations are the roof, Section 1, Section 2, painting, and Section 3, drainage. The homeowners are obligated to maintain everything else, at least that's the way I read the CC&Rs. But I guess, to me, I'm trying to figure out, is the argument being made by the HOA that common elements don't fall within West Park? Or is West Park the defining element as to construction defect because it's the thing it talks about, the case it talks about, new? So my impression of what I'm hearing from my opponent, who we've talked with many, many times, has been that the common elements don't require any analysis on new because they fall outside, I guess, the definition of construction defect. And I didn't see an exception for that in the statutory scheme. It appears that we're going to have, this court's going to have to wrestle with how do you define new for purposes of the unoccupied space around these condominiums. My impression from West Park is that you've said that the definition of construction defect requires a new residence. That new residence would seem to include all of the attendant land around it, no matter who has to maintain it, because that's a threshold entry point for construction defect. If it's not new, you don't get Chapter 40. And I think we're both agreeing that there's substantial evidence that the majority of these units were occupied prior to their sale, which means they fell within West Park, which means they're not new. The new twist, and I think it's very interesting, is that common areas don't fall within that definitional phrase, and therefore common areas don't have to be analyzed by new. But I think what it is that, again, we're not being sued by pools, sidewalks, foundations, roofs, and like that, we're being sued by individuals, and those individuals rise and fall on the definition of construction defect. Their units have to be new for them to enter into this. And anyone acting on their behalf, like the HOA, also has to go through that entry point. They have to have new units. And I believe that the court should set a bright line that if the majority of the units are not within and is operated as a single entity, which this one was, I don't think there's really a dispute about that, a single entity apartment building, then it should not fall within the definition of new. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. So, Mr. Mayor, you have 3 minutes and 2 seconds here.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
And your argument, again, it has to be restricted to the case number 61941, a rebuttal to the to Mr. Carlson's argument pertaining to your petition. And,
My position is that the common elements do not have to be new, that they are, in fact, appurtenances to the unit. Described that way in both the statute and described that way in the CC&Rs. And when you look at NRS 40615, which describes constructional defect, the only thing that the legislature clearly determined had to be new was a residence. And then as part of the interpretation of that by this court, that involves occupancy of a residence. What we know is that the common elements can never be occupied. They're completely outside of the units. They can never be occupied, so under the definition of West Park, they would, just incidentally, be new at all times. But what we also know is in the statute itself, when the legislature went on to describe a defect, it didn't say a new alteration or addition to an existing residence, and it didn't say a new alteration to an apartment. So we believe that the limitation with regard to new is limited by the legislature to residents, and it is also limited by the definition in West Park to residents. We think the reason is the same in each case. The common areas can never be occupied. They are pertinent to the units. Now, with regard to our Rule 23 analysis, we believe that in First Light 2 said, in cases involving no common elements, if the association brings a representative action on behalf of the unit owners for defects solely within their units, you have to do a Rule 23 analysis.
Why do we have to do a Rule 23 analysis? 116 does not require that. Nor does Chapter 40 per se. We're talking about this is 23 is for purposes of proof. How do we get to that point that you're trying to take us to?
Well, I'm not trying to take you to a point that an analysis is, Rule 23 analysis is needed here. I believe it's not needed here because we're only dealing with common elements. We're not dealing with the individual units. What the court instructed but what it is that when solely the units are involved or as to the units, a Rule 23 analysis needs to be done. It does not need to be done in a situation where we are pursuing common elements, because we have the right to pursue that with the general powers granted to an association and under NRS 116.31.02. So we believe that the court was correct when it refused to do a Rule 23 analysis for these common area elements.
There was a refusal based upon the fact that there was no request for a 23 analysis.
No, there was a request for a Rule 23 analysis in the lower court. And the court determined it was not necessary to do one.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Mayfield. Mr. Carlson, it was your excellent arguments and briefs, and we will take this case under submission with Justice Hardesty participating. We'll be in recess until 11.